Okay. So thank you all for being here. I also want to mention very quickly some of the sponsors, which is MyTax and Premia, the Professional Risk Managers International Association. So there's some Premia material outside and some MyTax. And if you want to know more about Premia, also you can ask me, as I'm the regional director in Toronto. Okay, so what I want to do today, when Brad asked me to try to think of a topic for Phil's talk, and of course credit risk is definitely one of the hottest topics, I also thought that it might be interesting to do something a little bit different than what most people do on credit risk. So most talks on credit risk focus on probabilities of default and the default models themselves. And while it's clearly a very important part of the whole credit risk puzzle, it is also fairly important, I think, to look at the other part of the equation, which is how much money you stand to lose in the case of default. So as we were trying to think of this, then we thought, okay, so we've been doing some interesting work on the way stochastic exposures affect portfolio credit risk, and I couldn't think of anyone better also than Greg Gofton to come and talk about LGDs and how they affect credit risk. So this is kind of the topic that we want to discuss for these full sessions. And what I want to do is, since my presentations are always very long and I always run on after my time, I thought of starting with the end so that way if I don't finish, at least you know what the conclusions are. So, and you can read the paper and at least you know what I want to focus on. So here's the key theme that I'd like to develop. First, the standard treatment of portfolio credit risk models really assumes that exposures and LGDs are deterministic, and even those models that in practice don't assume that they're deterministic, they do assume that they're independent. It simplifies the problem dramatically. So the question is, how good is that assumption, and if it's not a good one, how can we try to understand how that affects the problem? So what I'll try to do is present you a case study. I'll put it in the context of the BIS2 regulation because I believe it has a big impact on this. To try to demonstrate the impact of those stochastic exposures, and in particular of the correlations. It's the correlations that become, I think, the key in this particular problem. And what I'll try to show you is explain how it's really the effect from volatilities of those exposures or LGDs, the credit correlations and the credit and market correlations, and the granularity of the portfolio, which are the ones that are affecting the total capital required for a portfolio. So results have important implications in the way people manage their portfolios, but also for regulatory perspective. And as part of the regulatory discussions, I think that this might be an important thing. So as the theme of this whole session, I think it becomes fairly important that while you might use some analytical approximations and some simplifications, it's very important to get good data to model the problem right and also model the problem right. And to do that, you really need some form of integrated market credit simulation model and have very good data on how these exposures and LGD affect portfolio credit losses. So this is the general topic, and therefore what I'll try to do is I'll put the problem in context. I'll talk about credit capital and BIS2. I might spend probably a little bit too much on that, but I find that it's worth it. I'll talk a bit about credit exposures for derivatives as the example drives around that. Then I'll talk about general portfolio credit risk framework. I think it's important to set up the tools that we're going to use to do computation. And then I'll spend a bit of time on the case study. Please at any point interrupt me for any questions. So as I said, there are really three elements on credit risk that really constitute the total capital. It's the amount you lose when a counterparty or an obligor either defaults or changes their credit state. That's what we'll call exposure. It's the amount you lose when that obligor enters into default, and that is really represented by LGDs or loss given default, or sometimes their inverse, which is recovery rate. And really the model that we use to understand how likely it is for any of these obligors to default or migrate down. So when you put all of these three things in one place, you try to think of this putting in a big simulation engine, you put all your obligors in there, you get a total portfolio credit risk. So we'll try to analyze the effect of the assumptions we make on exposures and LGDs. So let me go very quickly to credit capital and BIS2, because that'll have some quick, big impact on the problem. So the new regulation, which has been, there are a series of papers that have come out since around 2001 in the official paper, really outlines three pillars for the new regulation. The first one is a minimum capital requirement. So there's a set of formulas that tell banks on a quantitative basis how much they should hold for capital for each of those transactions. Second one is a supervisory review process. So basically, not only the regulators are suggesting not only to rely on those quantitative assessments, but if when they go and do assessments within financial institutions, they need to make sure that all the processes within the bank are aligned with those calculations, and indeed that all the numbers they're using to make those calculations are used in practice by the bank to manage their money, to set limits, to set capital allocation, to do pricing, and to do compensation. And the third one is market discipline. So the idea there is to try to get transparency to the banks. So those are the core ideas. In terms of the minimum capital requirements, there are three different versions for three different approaches formulated in there. There's this revised standardized approach. So that is just a small revision to the 1996 Accord, the foundation internal ratings approach, and the advanced internal rating-based approach. What I'll talk about has probably the most relevance on the advanced internal rating-based approach, and that's what I will be talking about. And then there's another set of explicit charges for operational risk and for market risk. The market risk ones are similar to the ones in 1996 amendment. So when you look at the formula, the total regulatory capital comes as a set of basically dollar capital that each financial institution needs to assign to each of the instruments that they trade. So think about it on the credit risk side, that the capital formula basically says for every obligor that we're trading, for every, think of this for every borrower or for every counterparty, the regulatory capital is an exposure, which, as I'll show you, is really the expected amount they stand to lose when default occurs, and a risk weight. And there's a simple or complex formula for that risk weight, depending on how you look at it. And then there's an adjustment that's called the granularity adjustment, which was there in the first proposal, and now there's some discussion in the latest proposal. It seems that it might not be there in the end. The first term is supposed to capture what's called systemic risk, and I'll go and define this mathematically a bit more. And the 8% is simply something to standardize the numbers from the previous accord. As in the previous accord, there's this 8%, which is called the Cook ratio, that determines the capital for credit in the previous accord. So that's the general idea. So the risk weight contains a bunch of different things. There's basically the product of LGD, the loss given default, the percent that you stand to lose if a default occurs. There's a benchmark risk weight, which comes from a portfolio model. Oh, actually, I didn't do that. So, and I'll talk about it. There's an adjustment for maturities different from 3 years. So the assumption is that this benchmark risk weight is for a 3-year loan, basically. And there's really a cap, basically saying that the minimum or the maximum that one should pay should be kind of a percentage of LGD. The 12.5 is just to balance the 8% previously. So if you multiply 8% times 12.5, you get 100%. So think of the second term as just an adjustment for anything that's different from 3 years, and think of the risk weight to be something, the capital that you would have for $1 of exposure for a 3-year loan. That risk weight has a bunch of components, and that's the formula for the risk weight. N is the cumulative normal distribution function, and N minus 1 is the inverse of that. And R is some correlation coefficient between that obligor and the portfolio, which in the accord has an inverse relationship with probability of default. So that's the general formula. So don't think of the whole formula. The first term, I'll go and explain it very quickly, comes from a portfolio model, and that's the systemic losses that come, which include expected and unexpected losses, that come from a hypothetically asymptotically fine-grained portfolio. These are the systemic losses for the portfolio over 1 year for a 1-year loan. And the second adjustment is the adjustment that you would get from, and these are default losses, and the second term are really adjustments for mark-to-market losses for anything that is beyond 1 year. Here the idea is, well, we're going to measure capital as a 1-year credit losses, and there should be a difference between the capital that I assign to a one-year loan and a five-year loan, because intuitively the five-year loan is more risky. So the way to do it is to use something that's called a mark-to-market model. So the only reason you assign more money is because on a mark-to-market basis, that five-year loan might have credit migration within that year, and you want to assign an extra weight. And that formula there is just something that the regulators put in there to make things very, very simple, and it's just a fit that comes from pulling data. So it's just an empirical fit to try to do it, short of applying a full portfolio credit risk model. So these are the components. You probably don't have to go and look at the whole functionality of or the precise formulas there, but it gives you some idea of the components that come into this regulatory model. Here the simple idea is you need to be able to assign a risk weight independent of the portfolio to each of the particular assets that you have in there. Let me talk then a little bit about the exposure side for derivatives. So for derivatives, we have a little bit of a problem, because what do you use as exposure actually, right? That would be the first question. And, well, the notional of a swap is probably a very bad exposure number, because the notional is not something we stand to lose at any point in time. Really what we stand to lose is the difference in payments in an interest rate swap between a fixed and a floating leg. Also, the mark-to-market is not a very good measure, because when I enter into a swap today, I very likely enter the swap at par, so it would seem that I stand to lose nothing. So I need something to try to do that. And there's some evolution that has happened in terms of measuring credit exposure. The first part would be to say, well, let me use notional or some simple form of notional. And that works very well for loans. It works very well or decent for very simple loans, let me add. Works fairly decently for any floating rate instruments, like a par bond or something like that, because in the end, that's probably fairly good. But it doesn't work very well for derivatives, and it's as if you handle a derivative like a loan. And it doesn't consider at all this concept of potential exposure. With a swap, although you enter the swap today at par, and therefore you have no exposure, as interest rates move along, in a year you might have a big exposure to that counterparty if the swap goes in the money to you. So therefore, that's what we call potential exposure. The second level, which came in the 1988 regulation, says, well, use as exposure the mark-to-market, but put an add-on, which is something you read from a table, and that add-on tries to account for potential exposure. So how do you calculate those add-ons? Well, they actually put in some percentages of notional based on some empirical findings. Very easy to implement, it's better for derivatives, but it doesn't really capture the effects very well. So what happens if you enter a swap with a counterparty that pays fixed, and in a month you enter a swap of similar maturities with a counterparty that pays floating, and you have a netting agreement? Well, in that case, then your total exposure to the counterparty is very low, because those two swaps net each other. However, if you do this, you wouldn't be able to capture, and you would actually have twice the exposure of one swap. So that doesn't really capture anything that calculates offsets or netting. And the right way to do this, or the most efficient way of doing this, is to model each of these instruments, do it properly, and perhaps do it through simulation. There are some analytical approximations that some people have tried at various times to come up with, which are very clever implementations for certain things, but they don't work generally very well. The problem is really complex on how netting works and how some of these things work. So the basic idea is total exposure on the regulatory thing, it's potential exposure, and you read that potential exposure from a table. When you do simulation, the idea is very simple. Grab all your instruments with a counterparty, aggregate them, look at every risk factor that affects them. So if you have FX and interest rates, simulate all the FX, interest rates, equities, for long term for the life of that portfolio. Do some joint models that account for mean reversion, for the different factors, for possible growth rates, things like that. Then value each instrument under every one of those scenarios, accounting for maturity and time. Net, if netting is applicable, apply any collateral around there, and then aggregate the exposures. And in the end, you get some exposure profiles where you can get, say, the expected exposure over time, some 95 percentile or 99 percentile. So think of doing like a value at risk calculation for market risk over very long horizons. And it's computationally intensive, but it's completely doable today. We have today clients that would be doing these over 200,000 instruments overnight, 50 to 100 time steps, a few thousand scenarios, and this is completely achievable today with current machines. So while maybe 5 or 10 years ago it might have been a difficult thing to do in general, it is not that difficult to do today. A couple of things that make the problem a bit more complicated. So how you model litigation, how you model netting, collateral, margin calls, or credit triggers becomes very, very important in these portfolios. How you model credit derivatives? Well, here it's a little bit more complex, right? So you have a default swap. The value of the default swap doesn't only depend on market values, but depends on the credit state of the actual underlying obligor. So you need to do a simulation that includes all of those credit events for the obligor. So it's just a little bit more complex. And then the key thing is, how do you actually account for the fact that there's an actual interdependency between market events and credit events? And that's what's called wrong-way exposures. Let me give you examples of wrong-way exposures. So by wrong-way exposure, I mean that when I simulate a counterparty portfolio, I have scenarios where we have transactions in the money to us, where our exposure is higher, are also scenarios when it's more likely for the counterparty to default. So let me give you, for example, a couple of examples here, which are real. So imagine you do a currency swap with an emerging market sovereign, like Russia. However, the sovereign is paying in US dollars, or in Canadian dollars in this case, right? So therefore, as market conditions go bad for the ruble, then that's exactly when the sovereign is more likely to default for you. So you need to be able to model these things. So the exposure and the FX rate are perfectly correlated. Second one is interest rate swap with highly leveraged counterparties. So you do kind of, say, sell a swap to a hedge fund, and the hedge fund seeks to receive a fixed rate. So interest rates go up. That's exactly the time when your exposure goes up, and that's exactly the time when the counterparty might not be able to pay if their strategy didn't play very well. So you have a very, very high correlation between the market event and the credit event. And that's where you see that you can't avoid just being able to simulate this. Now, these look like very particular things, right? Things where this might not be very common, or perhaps some niche problems, but actually, there's some empirical evidence that this is actually happens all the time, both on the exposure side, and I've seen some studies also on the LGD side, as we discussed for portfolio credit risk. So there's a paper by Greg Duffy, who used to be at the Fed. I'm not sure whether he's still there. He actually grabbed all defaults, corporate defaults from 1971 to 1992, and he basically saw that there was a really, really big correlation between, just empirically, between the time counterparties defaulted and when their exposures were in the money. So for a portfolio of receiver swaps, that would actually imply that just with normal counterparties, on average, you would get 65% greater capital than if you assume that these two things were independent. And that's just not looking for the Russian deals or the highly leveraged portfolio for a hedge fund. This is something that happens a lot. Similar studies, I know of a couple of studies where people have raised actually the importance, similar effects for LGDs, where the LGDs actually do change dramatically with a business cycle. So clearly this is an important problem worth addressing. So what do we do? So when we try to measure capital in the portfolio, we need to bring in the exposures, the likelihood of those credit events, the process for LGDs, and trying to compute the whole thing. So let me try to, and in the end you'll get some loss distribution, which generally has a very fat, generally has a fat tail. It is skewed, and you can put in any particular statistic on that, such as expected losses, standard deviation of the losses, 95%, 99%, or very far in the tails, 99.9%. And use any of your favorite tail measures, like expected shortfall or conditional VAR or whatever you want. So that's really the objective. Now, there are many models in the market to do this, and they're actually a lot of proprietary software. Most financial institutions have built their own proprietary software. There's some commercial software that do this today. And really one important thing is when you actually read the literature, most of the different models explain things and present things in such a way that they look like they're solving completely different problems. So if you go and read the Credit Risk Plus document today, originally from CFPB, then it looks like they're talking about stochastic probabilities of default. If you go and read the KMV original documents, they look like they talk about the Merton model, which is a structural model. If you go and look at credit metrics, they talk about transition probabilities and mark-to-market. So the literature is actually quite confusing, or it used to be more confusing about 2 years ago. And there's a way to really put all these models in a general framework where you can look at all their differences and basically look at their differences in the way they do computation and in the way they actually make distributional assumptions. So I'll try to describe that model because that framework, because this is what in the end we'll use also to explain how we use for stochastic exposures. So you can think of having five steps, and instead of me actually reading them, let me show them to you graphically. So the first thing, think about the problem. Whether you actually think of implementing such a model this way or analytically, this might actually be the right thing to do. So the first step, think about it this way. The first step is we're going to grab every risk factor that affects the value of the portfolio or the credit worthiness of every obligor, and we're going to create scenarios. Think of a scenario as a path of all the financial factors affecting the values of every instrument there, like interest rates, FX rates, but also of every systemic factor that may affect the credit worthiness of all of those obligors. So that might actually be like macroeconomic factors or some industry indices or something like that. And think of a scenario as a path of all of these things. And we're going to generate many of these paths. Whether we do it explicitly or implicitly, it doesn't matter. Second step is on each of those scenarios and time steps, we're going to try to compute the default and migration probabilities of each obligor conditional on that state of the world. So hopefully we have a model that actually tells us how these probabilities change as the state of the world changes. So think about this, for example, in the simplest case, you might have an obligor which is an oil company, and therefore intuitively would think that if oil prices go down drastically, you would expect that the oil company might enter into some financial distress. They might have a higher likelihood to default. And therefore, this function basically looks something like this. They're sigmoid functions. So for one factor problem, think of this as some index of the economy. The probabilities of default go down as the economy gets better or go up as the economy gets worse. Right? That's the intuitive idea behind it. And there are different models. So whether you use a Merton model or whether you use a reduced form model, each of these models can be expressed in this particular way. And actually, a factor-based Merton model might look something like this here. So you can always express these models in this particular way. So it allows you to see the change in that basically sigmoid function on how those likelihoods change. So here's the idea. Let us not try to simulate right away the credit events, but their likelihoods. From a practical perspective, it's a nice thing also because computationally, these might be very low probability events in most of the time. That's generally the idea around it. So for each part of your books, people use different models. In the retail side, people use econometric models like logit models. For public firms, Merton-type models have always been very popular. There are actuarial-based approaches that use certain functions for that, sigmoid, et cetera, et cetera. And for different parts of your book, you can think that you can plug in a different model to do this. And that's really the general idea here. Then the second thing is, the same way as I have simulated all the factors, the systemic factors affecting default and migration, I'm also simulating all jointly all the financial factors that might affect the prices of securities. So I can really go and think that I could potentially compute the conditional exposures and losses given default in each of these states of the world. if you think about it, we never built explicitly the correlations between credit and market risk. They're built implicitly in the scenarios, right? It's a joint distribution, the joint processes that drive all the systemic factors driving default or migration, and the systemic factors driving prices of securities or loss given default, for example. So that's the third thing. So think about doing this step in the following way. For each of these scenarios, you're going to go and simulate an each time step. You're going to go and value each of those securities that you have in there. And then you're going to group them by counterparty and obligor. If there's netting, you net them. If you need to apply any collateral, you apply any collateral. So in the end, we'd like to think of this as a cube of values, which give you, for each counterparty, for each obligor, your exposure and your LGD also by scenario and by time step. It's a conceptual construct, right? And this is the same thing that I used really to describe these exposure profiles earlier on. And that's the key idea around it. So we have this thing. Third thing is, okay, so I know conditional state of the world, how much money I stand to lose, and what the likelihood is for me to lose any of those amounts for each obligor. So I need to do the convolution of all of those things. So we'll compute the conditional losses on that state of the world. A key trick here is that if those scenarios contain all the systemic components, then everything else is independent now. And because everything else is independent now, then I can use really some nice probabilistic tools, such as if the portfolio is huge and all these exposures are roughly the same size, I can apply the law of large numbers, or some central limit version of the central limit theorem, or probability generating functions, which is something that that, for example, Credit Risk Plus would use. But that part is something that can be done very efficiently from a computational perspective. And then you can do this for every scenario and for every time step. And in the end, if you want to get the unconditional portfolio losses, all you need to do is really average those losses over the scenarios. And I'm taking poetic license here, or artistic license. I'm not really summing the marginal distributions, but really the cumulative distributions. But it doesn't look as good. Trust me, I try the picture. It looks much better this way. That's the key idea here. I think that might be my phone, actually. It is. Oops. I'm setting the example here for my own talk. So let me add another thing. It's very easy to understand what systemic losses are in this by posing the problem this way. So think of the systemic losses formally. I'm going to assume that they're the losses that come from what I'm going to call an asymptotically fine-grained portfolio. So this is a portfolio that basically gets bigger and bigger, and I divide each of those exposures by 1 over n, where n is the number of obligors in the portfolio. Right? So basically, if you assume that you have an asymptotically fine-grained portfolio, the condition on a given scenario, the losses become the expected losses. All other moments vanish. So you only need to compute the expected losses, right? So that's the given idea. So you can assume that this is true because of the conditional independence assumption. And that's a key point. So graphically, the way it would look like it is the systemic losses, instead of having a full distribution there, it collapses to a single point in there. So it becomes a delta function, which is, of course, a very simple calculation. It's just the expected losses, which is conditional in that scenario. So that's LJ, that's the amount you lose conditional on being in that scenario, and it contains exposure and loss given default, and the probability of doing that. And you can also do this with credit migration. Just the formula gets a few other terms. So if you do this for every scenario, and basically your systemic losses is the loss distribution of expected losses under every scenario. And that's what it boils down to. The difference between these two is really what you can gain by diversifying more. That's the limit of how much you can reduce your risk for any measure that you do in those two distributions. Say you measure the 99 percentile as your credit VAR. The difference of 99% credit VAR from this one to this one is the maximum amount you can reduce your losses by purely diversifying without changing the systemic composition of your portfolio. It's a limit. You can't reduce it anymore. Diversification doesn't allow you. You need to now cross-diversify by perhaps entering into other markets or doing something else. But a key point that is worth driving for this credit portfolio is diversification, and the way you try to cross-diversify around this thing is the way to manage these portfolios, because you generally cannot get out of this deal. That's a general idea. So where do the risk weights for BIS to come into play? And that's the last part that I'll do in the next 5 minutes before I go into the case study. So the BIS, too, when I show you the formula, it was very evident that, first, if I really apply this around, first, you will notice a couple of things. If you want to get, for a very general problem, the risk contribution of one particular obligor or one particular deal, there's a way to make them additive, but the actual losses to that obligor or the actual percentile of losses are not their contributions. The contributions are portfolio dependent because of correlations. However, when I show you the formulas for regulation, an objective was to have weights that do not depend on the portfolio holdings that you have in some way. It's an objective because it simplifies the problem, right? It makes it very easy for people to understand, for credit officers to understand, and to implement. So there were two things. The weights, the risk weights, had to be portfolio invariant, and they had to be additive. So when the problem came along, the regulator started to think, okay, so on the WAT modeling, can we find a portfolio model that actually satisfies exactly these two constraints? Weights are additive and portfolio invariant. Under what conditions this is true? And Gordy from the Fed, basically on a series of paper, published one very good answer to the problem. So you can find this if you do the following two things. This is true if you only measure systemic risk, if you have an asymptotically fine-grained portfolio, and you have a one-factor problem. If your risk factor is only one factor. Turns out that it's very easy, actually. Then he did a little bit of analysis of convergence, of how fast does it take for a portfolio to become asymptotically fine-grained, and that's what became the suggestion for the granularity adjustment that I showed you earlier. Of course, that assumption is not a bad assumption, really. It's something you can work with, it's something you can correct, it's something you can do a lot. The one factor problem is something that is a big assumption and creates a lot of problems, but I'm not going to address it in this particular meeting. So when you look at this particular formula, I thought I had turned it off. I didn't. There you go. So when you look at this formula, this weight is actually the weight that comes from this one factor model, and it's a Merton model. So if you actually look at what it looks something like this. So let me assume that I have an obligor, and I have something that I call the creditworthiness index. Think of it in simple terms as the asset returns of the firm. And the obligor defaults when the assets fall below a given level, for simplicity, the liability. This is not always the case, and I'm using this just as an analogy. So if the creditworthiness goes beyond a given level, that means that they can't pay their debt, they will default. That creditworthiness index, I defined it by YJ for every obligor J, and it has a one-factor model to one systemic factor, which is X, and beta is basically the weight, the systemic weight of that obligor to the factor. And YJ is also a standard normal variable. X and epsilon are also standard normal variables. So I can write it very simple, right? The probability that the obligor defaults at one point in time is simply the probability that the index goes beyond a given level. And if I know the probability of that happening, the unconditional probability, this is like an inverse of that probability. So conditional on X, and X is the actual systemic factor, right? So remember, imagine that I have a scenario on that systemic factor, and that's the probability of that occurring. So if you work out the math, it's very easy to do a little bit of substitution, you get this formula. So you get the probability that the obligor default conditional on a scenario in the systemic factor X looks like this formula, which has a cumulative normal, inverse normal of the probability of default, and some other terms there, right? So that's pretty much, if you look at it, it looks pretty much like this formula here. R is what I call beta in there. So that's a general idea. We'll use exactly the same model when we do the case study just to make things comparable and to make it very simple. So that's a general idea. So think about it this way. In this particular framework, we basically have the conditional probability of default, one factor, the scenarios are on one factor, etc. And here is the next trick. Also for this one-factor model, I know that the quantile, so imagine I have 1,000 scenarios. The worst 1% scenario, so say the worst 10th scenario for the factor, is also the worst scenario for the losses, right? Because that's when the probabilities are higher. And I have the sigmoid functions, which are monotonic. So basically, on this one-factor model, I can choose a scenario right away that's going to be the worst one, or for any percentile measure. And that's really the trick. So if I know that scenario 3, in this case, represents a quantile on the risk factor, so that's the worst 1 percentile, it will also be the worst 1 percentile on my losses. And therefore, I only need to choose that particular thing in there. So I know that my credit var is going to come from that. So that's the general idea, and I'll leave it at that. So I'm going to skip a few things here in terms of other details on the regulatory formula. What I do want to stress, though, is now we have a way now of looking at the problem that will allow us to understand where the differences are between the real model and the regulatory model, or a nice, simple, intuitive way to think about these differences. So think about the regulatory capital as coming contribution of a systemic factor, perhaps an idiosyncratic factor if the granularity adjustment makes it in there, but if not, you can actually tell what it should be. That systemic factor comes from some default losses and some mark-to-market losses, so that's the difference of the maturity adjustment. And you can add mitigation, actually, because there's some rule for mitigation. And you can see which component in the formulas each of these conceptual components affect. And it's not important at this stage to go and look at this. What I think is important is to really think that when you compare the problem, I think you have to break it in the same way when you compute economic capital. So think of your economic capital problem, where you can also compute your systemic losses and idiosyncratic losses. That's what you need to compare them. You might have a model that integrates market and credit risk, that's what we'll do in the case study, versus a regulatory model. And then you can try to think of how you decompose the different losses. So for example, you might think, okay, what would be the losses if I didn't actually integrate market and credit, just assume that exposures are a single number? What would be the losses if I didn't have multiple factors, systemic factors, but just one factor? What are the differences just from the calibration that comes from the regulators? And you can break the different losses that you get from that problem. So what we'll try to address is really we'll have a single factor, so these two will collapse, and we'll try to address then what happens from that particular point. But from a general conceptual perspective, this is a lot of what we can do. So let me go to the case study, and let me then reiterate the motivation. So the first generation portfolio credit risk models really all assume, first, they're special instances from this global framework, and they all assume, in one way or another, that exposures are either uncorrelated or generally even deterministic. And that creates some problems in many cases, in particular when you're talking about derivatives. But I will argue that in other cases as well. And it's very easy to see this with a very simple example. And I'll go back to this simple framework with scenarios where, imagine I have only two scenarios, interest rates go up, interest rates go down, have simple portfolio, one swap pays fixed, one swap pays floating, and really what happens here is, in the first scenario, the first swap goes into the money, so I have a positive exposure, but the second swap is out of the money. I don't have an exposure. And it's Exactly the opposite in the other scenario. There's no way in the world I can have simultaneous exposures with these two guys, right? So it's really hard to see how we could actually justify having a model that will put the same things. And actually, we know that we'll get wrong, and the question that we'll try to answer is, how bad can we get? Is it that big a deal anyway, right? So that's a question that we'll try to address. So let me then try to go to it. And we'll use the same portfolio model, one-factor model, just to simplify the problem, because it will make it easy to change a few parameters. So I'll assume that every obligor has a one-factor. I'll assume that portfolio is homogeneous. Basically, every obligor is the same. I need very few factors to modify so that I can show you some effects in there. And I assume that everything is normally distributed, just to make things very simple. So these are the standard formulas. And we'll consider a series of these portfolios. So in this one-factor model, when I talk about modifying the credit correlation, I really mean modifying beta, that asset correlation. But I'll speak loosely about it as a credit correlation. When I talk about modifying, we'll assume that the exposures are stochastic and they depend on a set of market factors, and I'll explain how we'll go and measure that. And when we talk about scenarios, we'll talk about the joint outcome of the market factors and the single credit factor. So let me assume, for simplicity also, every obligor is a double B. So why? Because I want a probability of default of 1% to make things very simple. And I'll also make an assumption that we'll consider portfolios where each obligor contains one of two instruments, either a payer swap or a receiver swap. But that's it. And what we did is we did this study about a year ago, so we calibrated the model of how we simulated interest rates. We did a three-factor model for interest rate with mean reversion. The coupon of the fixed leg was about 6.6%. We assume LGDs of 100%. And what we'll do, and we assume mean reversion for interest rates, etc. The reason we went to a lot of detail on modeling the credit, the market side, is to have an idea that that volatility that we're using is meaningful, that we didn't make it up on the exposures. It was meaningful and it led to some reasonable results. Right, and 1% volatility made some sense. And we'll use a simulation approach to solve the problem so we know how to do it. So the first thing we'll do, let me grab those swaps, and we're going to simulate these swaps over time. These are the exposure profiles of the payer swap on the top and the receiver swap on the bottom. This is their mean exposure, their 95th percentile exposure, and the 99th percentile exposure. So if I look at some statistics, in a year from today, because we're going to measure risk in a year, the pay fixed swap has an expected exposure of about $89. These have notionals of 1,000. The receiver has about $13. You see that they're not perfectly symmetric, and that has to do with two things. First, we also didn't want to make all the swaps at the money right away, so we used the reset rate to be a little bit the rate like a couple of months before. So some swaps were in the money or out of the money. As you can see, the receiver swaps were actually in this stage in the money. That's why their exposure doesn't start at zero. And we also used mean reversion because we didn't want them to look perfectly symmetrical. That was another key thing. So just to make sure we're in tune here, if you look at the dispersion of these distributions in 1 year, the pay fixed swap goes, their expected exposure goes from $89 to 368, so about four times a tail measure than their expected exposure. The receiver swap is about 20 times, right? From $13 to 260. So you start seeing that first, using a single number. So which of these exposures should you be using? The recommendation, a lot of it comes say, okay, so use the expected exposure. And there's a reason for it. If all of these swap exposures were perfectly independent of each other, and we had a big enough portfolio, using the expected exposure will get you the right result, the right value. Law of large number comes into play again. And I'll show you how this converges in some examples at the end. But in this case, I have a single currency, in there, all these swaps are either perfectly correlated or perfectly anti-correlated. This is true for every trading book that I know of, right? For every currency, this is true. So there's no way to avoid those correlations within a given trading book. So it gives you some idea. So what we'll do is, so we've described the problem. So let me now go and tell you, okay, so we're going to compare all the time two models, a deterministic exposure model, a stochastic exposure model. In the deterministic exposure model, we'll use the expected exposures as the loan equivalent. So we'll assume that the exposures are flat over every scenario and they're their expected values. That's actually the recommendation, for example, that came from EASD about a year ago of using advanced models. Now, just as a little footnote, it would be way better to use a multi-step model because the timing of the exposure here is clearly very important. In this case, we'll avoid that problem because I want to simplify the problem. I don't want to focus on the multi-step. But you can actually make the problem a bit more complex in multi-step. And it's actually fairly important to measure this in many steps. So we'll do a bunch of things. We'll first do a base case, so a finite portfolio, and then we'll check each of the impacts of different parameters separately, just to try to get you an idea. So first case, let me assume I have a portfolio of 72 swaps. 72 is a weird number, right? Why did we choose 72? It just happened that we had a data set with 72, and it just happened that we wanted to make sure that it wasn't too big, just to be able to show granularity later on. But there's nothing magical about 72. We'll make some reasonable assumptions to start as the base case. So the credit beta square, so the correlation between obligors is 25%. The correlations, which makes beta about 0.05, which is somewhere like a reasonable assumption. And the market credit correlation, rho, is 25%. That's a correlation of the first principal component of interest rate and the credit factor that I had there, the X there. So if we go and measure the losses, this is the loss distribution, so this is the probability, cumulative probability, and this is the loss distribution, so that, as you see, it's a very, very truncated distribution. And these are the two distributions, the deterministic exposure versus the stochastic exposure model. First thing, already at the expected losses level, you have something like a 15% difference, $64 versus $77. Main reason, the correlations. You basically cannot go in the stochastic exposure case because of correlations and say your expected losses are your number of obligors multiplied by your probability of default multiplied by your expected exposure. Yes? Which one? The deterministic exposure basically assumes that exposures are deterministic, and the exposure that we use is the expected exposure in 1 year, right? Reason is, I'll show you later on, for a large portfolio without correlations, this would be the right thing to use. So if you go there and look at different variables, and we can go and look at all the numbers, but let me grab a tail measure, like this one to this one. The error is they're more than double. Like they're 2.5 times. The difference, right? It's not unexpected, right? You have a huge dispersion. So using an 89 as an exposure as opposed to something that can go to 400, you would expect this to be high. But first lesson is simple. It can be huge, the difference, right? It can be a big difference. In this case, in something like capital, you would be off by 2.5 times. So ballpark figure, you're wrong if you use the expected exposure case. And I'm not using like massive correlations. Also notice that the expected, this distribution is truncated. You can't lose more than losing for every obligor their expected value. So you multiply 72 by 89 by 1%, not by 1%, you'll get 6,400. That's the maximum you can lose. So this distribution is truncated there. While the stochastic exposure distribution goes a long way. Second point is, okay, so I grab the portfolio of payer swaps, right? It looks like maybe I I fix and I grab the worst case. I actually grab the best case scenario. Why the best case scenario? And on a percentage basis, look at the, it's very intuitive to see. The difference between the tail on the distributions in the tail is between 89 and 368, that's 4 times. In the receiver swaps, it goes all the way to 20 times. So if I had actually used the receiver swaps, the difference of 2.5 would have been way, way, way higher. I don't remember what it was exactly, but it was like 6 or 7 or 8 times. So that's a key point. So I didn't grab the, we didn't grab the best case. Then what the next thing you can do, and instead of looking at all the numbers, just think about it visually. All the numbers are in the paper, so you can actually look at them. Let's modify the credit correlation. So the correlation between each obligor within the with the whole portfolio. So that's the beta. So we use 25%. If I use 0%, the expected losses are the same for the two models, which is what we would expect. But the difference increases as the correlation increases. Actually, it's fairly linear for quite a while. But you can see, right, as you go to 99%, just intuitively think that using a 50% correlation is huge. Like you get a big difference. Now, you might think that 50% is probably a huge correlation. But if you have a portfolio of financials where everyone is kind of in the same ball, or a hedge fund portfolio, this might not be a bad, such a bad correlation. So you get what you would expect. This thing grows. It's kind of linear the way this grows. Let me grab the another one, which is, okay, we did it for the credit correlation. Let's do the same for the market credit correlation. So this is the correlation between market events and credit events, between the first principal component of interest rate and the credit driver. So the first line shows the standard, so this one, goes for the expected losses, right? Varying it from zero, so no correlation between market and credit events, to all the way to 50%. Now, you get exactly what you would expect. There's no correlation between market and credit events. There's no difference between the model. The x-axis, the y-axis, sorry, it tells you the difference between the percentage difference between the two models. So 200% means that one measures the difference. It actually is 200% higher. So what you get is something kind of intuitive. As you get a higher market and credit correlation, you of course get, once again, roughly a linear behavior. But here again, instead of, if you go and look at the market credit correlation, you can get an error of 180% in there all the way through. So this is roughly what you would expect. Time. Okay, so I'll close it very quickly. We can do the same now. Okay, so I looked at the portfolio where all the exposures are correlated between themselves. So assuming that everyone has either a payer swap or a receiver swap, let me get the other extreme example. Let me assume that we have a portfolio that's perfectly hedged. Half of the obligors are payers, half of the obligors are receivers, right? It's actually quite hard to tell which of the two models will give you higher numbers. And actually it turns out that the result, percentage-wise, give you very similar results. Actually, it's very hard to in this case, it's very hard to predict what happens, because on the one hand, you have an effect where you would expect these things to cancel out, so the differences to be smaller. On the other hand, you also have effects that make these things a little bit bigger, because now you have more scenarios where at least you will incur one loss. So it's a little bit hard to do, but this is really what ends up happening. Also, in this particular case, the numbers end up being a little bit higher also, because remember, percentage-wise, once we bring in the receiver swaps, the difference between the stochastic exposure and the deterministic exposure cases gets higher. That's another effect that we have in there. Let me do then the last case here, and let me then try to understand what happens in terms of systemic losses. If we want to put in some recommendation or have an understanding of what happens from a regulatory perspective, we have to talk about an asymptotically fine-grained portfolio here. Right? So what we'll do is we'll vary everything with respect to the number of obligors. So we'll go all the way to 1,500. And this is the case when we assume deterministic exposures. We express the losses now. These are the 99.9% losses as a function of this, as a percentage of the expected exposure size, right? So that's just a nice way to normalize the problem. So you can see the law of large numbers plays in. These are the systemic losses, which are roughly in the order of 17%. Now let's go to the other extreme. We'll use stochastic exposures, but let's assume that all of these stochastic exposures are independent of each other. So they're perfectly independent of each other. We would expect to use the for these two models to converge, and this is what happens. Actually, by the time you're around about 700 oligomers, you get them to be identical. And by that time, they're already at 17%. So you know roughly what happens there, and this is a rationale for why people are saying, okay, let's use the expected exposures for this problem. Now let's put in correlations into the problem. So we'll assume that the exposures are correlated, but market and credit risk are uncorrelated. So I'll assume rho is zero, but beta is in this case, all the swaps belong to the same currency. I'll assume that market and credit are uncorrelated. The exposures are correlated, but also the exposures become now perfectly correlated because they're swaps in the same currency. Right? So what happens is, at that time, we almost double the actual losses, even on the systemic case. In last case, let's assume that... So that difference contributes substantially, and that's really just for exposure correlation. That's what comes as an effect for the fact that the exposures are correlated between them. Lastly, let me assume that now everything is correlated. And that's what you get in the end. So you go from 17% to about 50% of losses. So really from a regulatory perspective, whatever the measure is here, really that is the contribution of market and credit correlations. And really what it boils down to is that in one way or another, if regulators were to assume this, somehow they need to put in some assumption that or some adjustment for that systemic risk, which comes from what I would call wrong-way exposure, from the fact that these exposures are correlated between them and perhaps correlated to the market risk as well. And that's the key thing. And as you can see, this is way bigger as an overall adjustment in this particular case than the granularity adjustment, for example, for a small portfolio. That's roughly the case, and hopefully this picture gives you some clear idea that basically ballpark, you would be wrong assuming that this is the case. Now, there, of course, I grabbed this and made it into a very simple example. The objective was just to have something simple enough to try to explain the results and the numbers. I have to browse a little bit fast on it, given that I'm running out of time. But hopefully it gives you some idea of how to understand the problem and how to think of where the effect for the exposures come here. So what I've tried to do is try to demonstrate that impact. And although I used a simple case study for swaps using exposures, really the results are fairly general. When you assume some form of correlations between LGDs or exposures, and the framework to analyze the problem is fairly much the same. The key factors that have a substantial effect are volatility of those exposures, in particular the credit correlations, the exposure correlations, and the market and credit correlations. And those effects never vanish, even if you go for very, very large portfolios. So the implications are obvious for both economic and regulatory capital. Just as a quick aside, so from a regulatory perspective, it seems to be, if whatever model it is, there needs to be some adjustment for that correlation if you wanted to capture the risk properly, or find a way to use the right measure. Now, having said that, when I've presented this, and I've been doing this for a bit in a couple of conferences, and this is a published paper, I've had people asking me, okay, but why did you use the expected exposure. Why not use the 95 percentile exposure? Well, if I had used the 95 percentile or the 99.9 exposure for each of the obligors, I would have completely overestimated it. And actually, which exposure, which percentile you use for those exposures depends on the actual correlation on the problem. It's a problem of correlations that is at stake here. And while you might be able to try to look at the problem in simple ways through simulation, through analytics, the problem really becomes very clear once you look at it through simulation. And that's the last thought that I give you. And before I stop, I've pretty much finished on time, so which is surprising given that it's me. So thank you very much for your time. I'll be very happy to answer questions if there's some time.